Our next case, Alvera versus Blitton Gaines. Mr. Edelman.
Hi. How did we get such a day?
It's funny.
Yeah.
You'll know when you get to heaven.
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Edelman.
I may please the court, counsel. This is a Fair Debt Collection Practices Act case that turns on the rate of interest applicable under Illinois law.
Speaking of Illinois law, has there been any decision? We didn't see it, but has there been any decision yet in the Hund case?
It was argued last week, and no decision has come out yet. It involves a statute passed in 1845. As originally phrased, the statute says, quote, no person or corporation shall directly or indirectly accept or receive in money, goods, discounts, or thing in action, or in any other way, any greater sum or greater value for the loan, forbearance, or discount of any money, goods, or things in action than is above described, end of quote. Originally, the rate was 6%. At the present time, the applicable rates are 5% without an agreement, 9% with an agreement.
Now, Section 1692 F1 of the FDCPA prohibits the collection of any amount unless it's expressly authorized by the agreement creating the debt or permitted by law. Here, the debt, including the interest, is expressly authorized by the agreement creating the debt, and no state law affirmatively prohibits it. So how was the FDCPA violated?
F1 has been construed as requiring either an agreement that authorizes the interest and is not contrary to state law, or a state law which authorizes a charge to be imposed regardless of an agreement. Court costs would be an example of the latter.
Couldn't a state law be common law since we're post Swift versus Tyson, right?
It could be common law, but under Illinois common law, there is no right to charge interest. The Illinois Supreme Court has repeatedly held.
But there's a common law of assignments, isn't there?
There may be a common law of assignments, but regardless of whether you're an assignee, an original creditor, whatever, under Illinois common law, there is no right to charge interest. The default rate is zero.
Doesn't your reading mean a debtor could receive a better interest rate than he bargained for simply because his debt was assigned to an unlicensed entity? I mean, isn't that what it boils down to?
That is the function of a usury statute. It constrains what...
But what's the danger in allowing an unregulated entity to collect the very same amount, the same rate of interest that a regulated assigner could charge and that was part of the agreement?
Your Honor's question assumes that the function of regulation is limited to the original terms and has nothing to do with collection practices. But that's not the case. Look, for example, at what happened to Ocwen, which is the only debt purchaser to get a regulated charter or license. It's operating under an OTS supervisory agreement because it engaged in abusive debt collection practices, and the agreement orders it to cease and desist from improper debt collection practices.
But that's an extreme example. I mean, and there were some unsavory practices there. But if the assignee stuck with what the original agreement was, I still want to know what's the harm.
The harm is that under Illinois law, you have a choice. You can charge a low rate of interest, not exceeding 9%, if you don't have a regulatory license, or you can submit to regulation and examination, in which case you're not subject to any limitation.
So the law... I just want to, just so in terms of assignment, you just think that's just not valid in Illinois.
That is correct. It is quite, well, first, in terms of a lot of the practices that debt buyers engage in and that are pertinent to this case would not be permitted by regulators. For example, buying a debt for a couple of cents, holding it on your books for a long period of time while the interest runs up. Regulators require prompt resolution of debts, and in fact, that particular practice was recently outlawed in the Payday Loan Reform Act, which just was passed, with respect to regulated CILA, Consumer Installment Loan Act licensees, failure to document loans, failure to resolve consumer complaints. For example, Mr. O'Vera's identity theft claim.
Have the state regulators tried to regulate these assinees?
The state regulators are undermanned and have...
Well, you call it undermanned, but why isn't that their interpretation of their law? If they don't think that they either have the power or that they have a need to regulate these assinees, because the assinees, after all, they are regulated. I mean, they're subject to your favorite statute, right? The federal statutes that regulate debt collection.
That is not equivalent to the supervision and regulation which they would get by having an appropriate charter.
It's better.
No, Your Honor. I do not.
You don't think you're a better regulator than you just said they were undermanned and. Right.
Your Honor, I do not have the authority to issue a civil investigative demand to somebody without any reason to believe that they're engaging in an unlawful practice and in audit or inspect their books and records. That's what banking regulators visit periodically and do that.
Yeah, well, speaking about unlawful, I mean, you seem to be suggesting that the defendants are engaged in the business of sales, finance agencies, but that they're operating without licenses and they're operating contrary to law. In fact, you actually suggested that this, you know, this might be a felony under 205 ILCS 660/15. Is that what you're arguing?
No, Your Honor. A sales finance agency is one type of license which they could get, and in fact, a sales finance agency is defined as a professional purchaser or assignee of consumer debt, and we cited that to refute the proposition that Sections 5 and 6 of the Interest Act do not apply to assignees. But they could also get, if they otherwise conformed to the standards of conduct authorized under the statutes, a consumer installment lending license. They Ocwen attempted to get a federal savings bank charter. All of these would impose the same examination and regulation requirements. Those requirements would apply to collection practices as well as the terms in which they contracted. And in each case, it is unlawful to conduct business without having the license, and it is also unlawful to attempt to transfer or assign the license.
But isn't it curious that 160 year it took 160 years for anyone to notice that this that the statute applied to assignments?
Your Honor, the debt buying business is quite recent, so.
Assignment of debt is not recent.
The Illinois Supreme Court has repeatedly held that assignees are subject to the Interest Act.
Do you mean that in 1845 or 1900 or 1950, Illinois banks and so on, other creditors were not assigning debt?
Not at all. Look, in fact, if you look at the cases we cite, they're from that period, and they repeatedly hold that the assignee is subject to the constraints of the Interest Act. The only thing novel about this case is the fact that you have more recently acquired exemptions which are based on whether you have a regulated charter. For example, the Consumer Installment Loan Act came in 1963. It now allows any rate of interest on the condition that you subject yourself to regulation and examination. You did not have that differential until then, and more recently, you have the business of purchasing bad debts. That's something that's grown up during the last 10 years or so, and That's why it is brought to a head at this time, but there is certainly no suggestion that for 160 years this practice has been going on and the regulators have tolerated it. If there is a question...
But, of course, there's a difference between saying the person who actually deals with the debtor to make the loan has to be registered and regulated and so on, because, of course, there's a concern there. But if that's a reputable person dealing with the borrower, then why not assume that his assignment policies will also be reputable? Couldn't you, for example, if a licensed creditor, assignor, was dealing with disreputable assignees, wouldn't that jeopardize his license? You could go to the board and say, look, this assignor is transferring these very high interest debts to these sharks, and he shouldn't be permitted.
I think that the duty of the lender, the original lender, is simply to, in effect, auction these debts off. They don't get very much. It's a couple of cents on the dollar. But their obligation to their shareholders is sell it for the highest price, and there is generally done by an auction-type process.
But the regulators, couldn't the regulators tell the assignor you can only auction to debt collectors that are reputable or that are licensed? I mean, why do we have to intervene under federal law? Why not leave it to the state to decide what to do with these assignments?
Well, one of the things we request is that the matter be certified to the state Supreme Court so that the state can answer the question. But
we're waiting for the Hund case. Why would we be certifying when we're waiting for it to go through the state system?
More directly to answer Judge Posner's question, I don't think that the original lender has any real idea of who the borrower, the purchaser is, or what their qualifications are. The debts are often resold.
But the lender could impose any restrictions he wanted in his assignments, right? He'd say only assign to, Chase Manhattan or some other hugely reputable enterprise.
And prohibit them from selling it to someone else?
Well, you wouldn't have to if you're dealing with really reputable companies, presumably.
Not really. Because
there are no reputable
companies. No, Your Honor, because the debts are basically freely traded. They're often securitized.
They were freely traded. You want them to be untradable now.
No, Your Honor, I want them to...
This is absurd, right? You can't have a situation where you make a loan at 20% and then you turn around and assign it and the assignee can only collect 5%. That doesn't make any sense.
I don't think it's at all absurd. I think that's exactly what Illinois law
But it is absurd, right? Because there was a reason why it was a 20% loan.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? And so who is going to buy that loan and just collect 5%? Well, there'd be a huge discount, right?
Given the fact that there's already a huge discount when they're charging 20 or 30%, I don't think it would affect the marketability of the debt at all.
Well, of course it would, because the less that the assignee can charge in interest, the less it will pay for these debts in these auctions, right?
Not necessarily, because what it would be then required to do is promptly collect or get rid of the debt.
There's a reason why there's interest on it's not, what do you mean get rid of it? It's like like a hot plain hot potato?
No, you're
right. Say to someone, I have a debt from some very marginal, I have a very marginal borrower here. He had to pay 20%. I can only charge 5%. I got to get rid of this quickly. So who's going to take it? Who's also going to just be able to charge
5%? A lot of these debts are simply not collected, and they're in many cases the purchaser doesn't collect the debt and simply writes it off.
Well, now wait a minute.
The purchaser knows
it all about. If you're planning to buy debts and not try to collect them, you're not going to pay very much for them, right? That's a funny business. I buy debts, and then I write them off.
The purchasers of these debts are well aware that perhaps 10 to 20%, some a fraction substantially less than half, are collected. Mm-hmm. They're also aware that...
But if they can't charge interest, right, then it's an even more unprofitable line of work.
All that they would be prevented from doing is sitting on the debt for a number of years and then running up interest in the interim. And that's something regulated.
You say sitting on the debt. They might actually be making efforts to collect the debt, but it's not instantaneous. And that's why they want to have interest in this period while they're trying to collect.
Well, they certainly don't need 30% interest when they've paid a penny or two on the dollar.
Yeah, but even if you go beyond, let's say they've made all these efforts to collect. And after 4 or 5 years, they still would want to collect. Even if they're writing it off, they want 20%, not 5%. That gives them a bigger write-off, the potential of...
It does not, Your Honor. They only get to write off what they paid in the first instance. They do not get a write-off for interest which they've run up and...
So that's
why
flat.
Not? Why not?
I don't know for what
every month. So the first month the debtor owes them $100, and at the end of the year it was $120. Well, that's a genuine debt. That $120, $100 plus the interest. And if you can't collect it, you write it off, can't you? Why couldn't you write that off as a loss?
Because
you were entitled to that interest.
Your basis,
the debt kept growing. Mm-hmm. That's your whole. The debt kept growing. It was 20% greater. So instead of losing $100, I lose $120.
Well, you didn't pay $120.
No, I paid $100.
No, if
that's
you're a debt
a
buyer, you paid about $2 for that debt.
Oh, fine. I paid $2, right? And at the end of a year, I'm entitled to $2 and 40 cents, right? And now I've lost the $2.40, so I deduct it from my income for mm-hmm. the year. What's wrong with that? There's some rule in the tax code against that? Maybe there is.
As I stand here, I'm not certain whether you would deduct the $2 or the $2.40,
right.
But you would not deduct the $120.
Well, if you had paid $100.
But no debt buyer will do
well,
that.
Well, no, but look, maybe the loan was for $1,000. I buy it for $100. At the end of the year, I'm entitled to $120. Right?
Yeah.
But whether it's $2 or $100, doesn't matter. The point is, the interest is accrued, and it's a receivable, and if you can't collect it, you get to deduct it, I think, unless there's some mm-hmm. special wrinkle.
I thought it was tied to your basis, but to what you actually paid for the debt, and that the interest doesn't enter into
we're
it.
Talking,
but,
yeah, but anyway, that's peripheral. So anyway, your time has expired. I'll give you some rebuttal time. So, Mr. Schultz?
May it please the court, counselors. The issue is pretty narrow in this case. It's whether a debt buyer can collect interest on a defaulted debt at a rate consistent with the credit card agreement. There's not a lot of case law on this. It's all at the trial level, and every case that's ever decided this issue is decided in favor of the debt buyer's position and against the plaintiff. Almost all of those cases have come out of this the Seventh Circuit area.
Are you seriously contending that the Interest Act does not apply here? You argue it applies only to lenders of money and contend you're not lenders, but the Act begins with the words, no person or corporation, and proceeds to describe all collectors of debt, not just lenders of money. I mean, on what basis do we ignore the plain language?
I think we're looking at the language of the Act at the time of the initiation of the transaction, not after it's been in default and been assigned. Those provisions that would all of a sudden kick in to the S&E, that is not correct. It wouldn't apply there. And I think that's what Judge Cannelli was saying in the O'Berry case when he said the Illinois Interest Act does not deal with the interest in S&E who was not an original party to the credit agreement.
But I think Judge Rovner is asking, what is the statutory language on which you rely for that interpretation?
I believe it's 205.5 where it talks about the interest that's allowed.
So be concrete. So
yes,
where is the statutory language?
Well, I think right out of your original question.
Is it in your brief?
205.5/5. It talks about the rates.
And could you speak louder also?
It's 205.5. It talks about the rates that may be a charge.
This is 205.6, is it?
That's the penalty provision.
What?
205.5 deals with the rates that may be charged, and it says there's certain rates that may be charged.
Now, which are you talking about? 205.6 or something else?
205/5, I believe.
5? Okay, that's on page 12 of your brief.
Page 2. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm on the blue brief.
Page 12 of your brief.
Okay.
No person or corporation shall directly or indirectly accept, is that?
Right.
And so what are you hanging your hat on there?
The very last part of it where it talks about or other laws of the state. And what you were speaking about with other laws of the state were assignment laws. In this situation, and what Judge Kennelly and Judge Moran were talking about in their discussions.
Well, what does assignment law say that, or
well, they go back and they cite cases from the 1800s that talk about the assignee.
You have
takes
to speak louder.
They go back to the 1800s and they talk about the assignee's rights are the same as the assignors. And in this situation, the assignors, if regulated by Illinois, most of these are, in this case, these are South Dakota credit card agreements or Delaware credit card agreements. It's the particular laws of those states. If the assignor was acting consistent with whatever the laws...
But aren't you bothered by the fact that in 1845, the word laws was usually understood not to include common law, right? That's the Swift versus Tyson case. So, do you have any evidence or, you know, reason to think, besides the kind of practicalities of it, why laws of this state should include common law of assignment?
Other than all the cases that have discussed it have agreed with that principle, and we've cited to cases that go back, in our briefs. Every judge has agreed with that principle, that when they're talking about that, they're talking about the laws of assignment. And assignment law said that the assignee would take the same as the creditor.
Are any of these assignees corporations from other states or other countries?
I think that many, probably, of the assignees are outside the state of Illinois.
How do you respond to the concern that allowing only regulated entities to charge higher interest rates can help protect the public, which is one of the arguments counsel...
I don't think that there's a doubt that when there was an original credit card issued, that institution was regulated by whatever entity was supposed to regulate it. But as you're talking about, there's a certain concern with regulating lenders and making sure they're properly capitalized and have certain credibility and ensuring that when a merchant accepts a credit card, that is going to be paid for. And that's what happened in all these instances. That merchant was paid, but the lender, the financial institution, was not.
But
I think there's
this,
not the same.
Why would this? you're all sensitized because of the last case.
Trying to be careful.
Why would the state regulate license debt collectors more closely than unlicensed ones?
Well,
I mean, see that.
This is debt buyers.
But your interpretation seems to me to lead to that result. And it seems to go against...
Well, I don't want to blur the lines. There's lenders, and they're regulated. There are collection agencies, and they are also regulated by the FTC under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and as well by the Department of Professional Regulation in the state of Illinois under the Collection Agency Act. But we're dealing with debt buyers, something a little different. Now, it's true that there are oftentimes debt buyers that are themselves debt collectors, and their conduct would then be regulated when they're collecting debt.
Okay, well, then help me with this. How do these collection businesses... differ from the sales finance agencies?
They're not making any... There's no lending transactions. There's no loans being made by the entities. None. No lending.
Are all these assignments for purposes of collection? Or?
Yes. Yes, that's what they're designed to do. Chase Manhattan, you spoke about Chase...
I mean, you could have assignments, obviously, just a way of spreading risk or something, but these are assignments for collection.
Absolutely, and you spoke about, I think, Chase Manhattan Bank, and there's Capital One, and there's Providian. There's a number of large institutions, and that's what they do. This is part of their economic plan of sorts. Is they make loans, they have credit cards, and they try to collect once they go into default. They'll stop the card from being used. They try,
okay.
And as part of the stream of commerce, at some point, they will write it off, I suppose, and then they sell it, and that's the sales. Now, I don't want to accept, and I don't think the court should either, it's 1 or 2 cents. There's a much different market. It depends on first placement.
The plaintiffs, you know, have suggested that you are engaged in the sales finance agency business without a license, contrary to law. That was at page 30 and 31 of the blue brief.
They're not involved in that type of business at all. And I think it's.
I mean, you can't just say they're not involved in that type of business at all. You have to explain it.
I think I can explain it by explaining what it is they do. I suppose is they on the market they purchase these defaulted portfolios. They're not trying to get them back into a servicing situation like some mortgage. The people in the mortgage business may want to do that. These are debts that are a couple years old usually, as were these particular plaintiffs. They were charged off within, I think, less than 2 years of the they were purchased within less than 2 years, and they sought to recover. And
okay, you know, so what you're saying is these assinees, they're not lenders. Hmm. They're collection agencies. They're not fixing an interest rate. They're not doing any of that stuff. They're
absolutely.
Just collecting, and the interest rate is just to tide them over while they're trying to collect. Let me ask you: if a retailer charges interest for late payment, is that subject to the to this statute, to 205? Do you know?
I'm not 100% sure. I assume it is. But if they're regulated by the state of Illinois, it perhaps would kick in.
But it's another problem. Does a retailer have to have some kind of a license before he can charge?
I know a lot about the debt buying and collection agency industry. I don't want to speak to that necessarily. I would assume so if they're regulated by Illinois. And that's another problem with this theory of his. Is under the theory of the plaintiffs here, is you'd be subject to the interest acts of every state. So that would seriously impact the ability to sell these on the market from the Chase and the Capitals and others, because in Indiana, for instance, it's 21%, in Illinois it's 9%, in some states it's 5%. That would impede it as well. And I think it's important, you hit on right away, and I think that's telling. This has been around for more than 10 years, and it's been around for a long time, this business, this exact way they're doing business. And the Department of Financial Institutions has never come in and said you're charging too much interest. The Department of Professional Regulation has never come in and said that. The Illinois Attorney General has never come in and said they're doing something wrong in connection with this transaction. That's telling. This is an interesting argument. It's an argument that should be made in Springfield, not in the courthouses, not in the federal courthouses, certainly. I don't believe.
Why are you giving them ideas?
Well, because you know what? Here, because I've had clients, and I've done this myself, and your clerk, city court, could do it. You can call them up. You say, does this company have to be licensed by you? And they'll tell you, no. I've got letters from the agency saying no. It's not. They've chosen, for whatever reason, but they've chosen, and this act doesn't change that, in my mind. Not to regulate them as these
did
claims.
You argue the Hun case?
I did argue the Hun case. It was argued in the Third District Appellate Court on Thursday afternoon. It's interesting when you're talking about. I don't want to cut off your question, though, but
okay.
You know, they asked in the Hun case to certify that to the Illinois Supreme Court, and the court turned that down.
One of the things counsel said is, if the interest rate was that 5 or 9%, that really wouldn't have an impact on assignments. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely disagree with
what
that.
Everybody agreed to.
I would not agree with that at all. And I am not a debt buyer, but I certainly have many clients that are debt buyers, and I've raised that issue with them. I've discussed that issue with them, and they say that would seriously impact the ability for them to get loans to purchase these portfolios, because the overall value and how it can continue to raise in value is going to be a factor when they're considering financing these purchases.
Is there any – Mr. Edelman said that most of the loans – so they buy a batch of these, and, of course, many of them are not worth pursuing further. And he said 10 or 15%, whatever the figure is. Is there any information on how long it takes to from when you buy these things to affect a successful collection?
Well, it's a market factor, really. There's many different levels of debt buyers, and there's some that are better and more sophisticated in ferreting out what is good paper to buy and not good paper.
But I'm just meaning the time, because presumably, so what happens is you buy the stuff and you write a letter to the debtor and you say you owe this, and then you advise them, you know, interest is accruing at 20. We've had a lot of those cases.
Sure.
What you have to tell these people. So then is there some interval over which some standard time that it takes, if the person is going to pay, that he will pay?
I don't think that there's any statistic that would show that. I don't think the trade associations would have such a statistic. I don't think there's something that I could point to advise the court on that. It really is business by business. And I think the one thing that in your question, though, you've got to understand the distinction in part, if possible, is that there are the debt buyers, which are oftentimes just funding vehicles, and then there's the collectors. And the debt buyers will use affiliated companies, perhaps, or they'll send it out on the market. And for instance, in this instance, Mr. Blitt was a lawyer who was seeking to recover. He did not own the debt. He was not charging or accruing the interest himself at all in the first case. So there are different distinctions, though, when you're talking about the debt buying and the collection aspect of this type of portfolio.
But I thought you said these debts were just bought for purposes of collection.
They are. They are bought for purposes of collection. So they're purchased.
But you're saying there's a debt buyer who would then turn to a collection agency if he wasn't a collection agency himself?
Right. So they would. There's the debt. There's oftentimes just a purely a debt buyer, and then they will farm them out to agencies.
Right.
So there's other ones that will use subsidiaries, affiliates, to do collection, and some that will send it directly to a lawyer, and some that will send it to an affiliate who then hires a lawyer. However, I mean, there's different streams of commerce that they use, programs that they use, and this business has been around for a long time, and I think that if I go back to anything, it's the fact that this interpretation has been rejected every time it's been raised by any courtroom. It's never been accepted by any regulatory body. I don't believe the Illinois legislature accepts this. It's a novel one. It would create, in my mind, somewhat of a havoc within the industry to try to apply these different 50 different states' interest acts, some of which may have, some of which may not have, but I think most of them do have something like that, and impact that on a portfolio, a commodity of some sort. In the Hund argument, Mr. Edelman spoke about there's something in the neighborhood of $68 billion of debt out there like this. And what is this debt?
Would you repeat that?
I've heard that, and that's not my quote, but $68 billion in debt, bad debt. This is a serious problem. And this industry provides somewhat of a vehicle to address that problem. What's the debt? It's largely credit card debt. There's a fairly significant component of student loans. There's medical, which is usually copay and deductible situations. I don't believe, although I may be wrong about this, the municipal type debts, and I don't, fines and penalties, I think they'd fall within that category. I'm not sure if that would be within that type of number, but it's large. I mean, we're talking about a large number. I see my time is up.
$60 billion sounds low.
It could be. It could be. I mean, I've heard different things.
Did you say 68 million or billion?
Billion. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Schultz and Mr. Edelman. Your time expired, but you have a couple of minutes, so take some whacks at Mr. Schultz.
Well, I'll be very brief. First, with respect to what other states provide and whether this is a clog on the sale of debts, some states expressly regulate the S&E. The UCCC states, such as Indiana, do that. There are about 5 to 7 of them. A couple of states expressly say that the S&E can charge the same rate as the original creditor. I think California is in that category. And then there are others, such as Illinois, which make the rate you can charge turn on whether you are regulated. With respect to the construction of the statute, the language, there are numerous provisions which indicate that assignees are covered. In sections 5 and 6, not only does it say any person or corporation, but it prohibits a total of 3 acts: contracting for, receiving, accepting interest. Lenders contract, but why do you need to then prohibit receiving and accepting? Because that covers the S&E, that covers the debt collector.
How would your clients be any better off in the long run if, as a result of the position you're arguing, the lender stopped assigning, and instead, they'd sit on these things for years, accruing interest, and then turn it over to a collection agency, and then they're not subject to any.
Well, the lenders wouldn't be allowed to sit on it for years. They're required to the regulators require them to promptly resolve debts, and as a result of that, they would have to sort of fish or cut bait promptly.
So is your basic argument that there's a loophole here because the prompt resolution doesn't apply to the assignees? unless we adopt your interpretation. Is that the problem?
Well, the assignees are trying to create the loophole by saying that they neither have to be regulated, which requires prompt resolution, nor limit
or
their rates.
Or drop down the interest rate.
Yes. But I think my clients are entitled to one or the other, and either benefits them materially.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much,
you.
Mr. Edelman and Mr. Schultz. Very interesting argument. Well argued. Our next case.